You see, when it's drizzling, this bumper to bumper gets even more slow. So I think I was delayed just there in the traffic jam. Okay, but thank you very much. Am I forgiven? Now, I'm waiting for it from this side. Am I forgiven? So you're not forgiving me? Sheila? You're not forgiving me?
No, I'm not
babe. Mom's nukanyana? No. Smongile? No. Okay, no, that's fine. But you know that where there's forgiveness, there's breakthroughs in your life. No? Okay, no, that's fine. Let me find out if we all have the cop of the agenda. So we all have. All right, thank you very much. Okay, in terms of the agenda, we are on item number one, which is opening. As usual, I would like us to open this meeting by observing a moment of silence for prayer and stroke or meditation. Thank you. And then there is such a simple. Okay, all right. No, that's fine. Well, I would like to greet you once more, honorable members. And also, I would like to greet the Human Science Research Council delegation. I'd like to greet the staff and thank them for arranging this meeting. All stakeholders and all guests, you are all welcome. Please feel free. This is our meeting. I'm welcoming all of you to this very important briefing from Human Science Research Council on the 2017 MTBPS. The Human Sciences Research Council is an important and valued partner to the Standing Committee on Appropriations. The mandate of the Human Science Research Council, Sciences Research Council, entails informing the effective formulation and monitoring of government policy, evaluating policy implementation, and disseminating research-based data and fact-based research results. This is critical in the context of the MTBPS, given the challenging situation the country finds itself in. The MTBPS states that unless decisive actions or action is taken to chart a new course, the country could remain caught in a cycle of weak growth, mounting government debt, shrinking budgets, and rising unemployment. Much depends on the policy choices made and the effectiveness of their implementation. Hard choices are required to return the public finances to a sustainable position. Hard choices. So it is clear that Parliament will need to fully consider all possible policy options on how best to use the limited resources that we have, especially in ensuring that the budget is truly responsive to the people's needs. Let's have a robust and fruitful engagement as we work towards transforming our country. Thank you very much. These are my welcoming remarks. I'll then move on to item number two, which is apologies.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. We have two apologies, one from Honourable McLachlan and one from Honourable Mr. Totten, who is attending to constituent the matter today. Mr. McLachlan is supporting family.
Okay, Honourable Members, do you accept the apologies? Apologies accepted. Thank you very much. Shall we move on to item number three, which is presentations by the Human Sciences Research Council? And this will be followed by deliberations. So I would like to hand over to you, sir. And yeah, we are in your hands. If you can once more just introduce your delegation so that we, you know, get used to their names.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you, members of the Standing Committee on Appropriations, for asking us to come to be here. We really appreciate the invitation, and say that we always look forward to this engagement with the Committee on Appropriations. My name is Crane Sodine. I'm happy to be called Crane. I am the Chief Executive Officer of the HSRC, and I'm going to ask my colleagues to quickly introduce themselves, please. Peter?
Yeah, my name is Peter Jacobs. I'm an economist within the HSRC.
My name is Barra Kanyani. I'm the Research Director at the HSRC.
Thank you.
Good morning, Honourable Members. My name is Lakeness Simbai. I'm the Deputy CEO for Research.
Okay, thanks.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Charlene Swartz. I'm a sociologist and a Deputy Executive Director in the Human and Social Development Program of the HSRC.
Good morning, colleagues. My name is Priscilla Reddy. I'm the Deputy Executive Director for Population Health and Health Systems Innovation. Nice to be here. Thanks.
Good morning. My name is Noor Fakir. I'm at HSRC IT.
Thank you very much. Just to reassure you, we take you very serious and we take your work very serious. So we're happy that you were able to come and make us cleverer with facts. Thank you. Over to you, Crane.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. So we begin, Chairperson, with a very important statement made by Minister Gigaba on the occasion of the delivery of the midterm budget. He said, "We are giving an honest view of the challenges facing our country. It is not in the public interest, nor is it in the interest of government, to sugarcoat the state of our economy and the challenges we are facing. It is only when we understand these challenges fully and candidly that we will know what to do and can decide what course we must take in addressing them, as well as what trade-offs we must make in the national interest." Thank you. So, Chairperson, what we're going to do here is to try and speak in the tone and in the register in which the Minister himself introduced his speech. We're going to start with an analysis of this question of economic growth, and that will be followed up by a short presentation on infrastructure investment, and then we'll move on to these sectoral issues of education, health, and local government, and we close off with a commentary on social cohesion and higher education. And we take the opportunity of talking to the major risks which face us inside of the country. This last part of the presentation, the last point there, summarizes a response that we put together for colleagues here in Parliament a few weeks ago. We are going to begin, Chairperson, with Peter Jacobs. And he'll be taking us through slides one, two, just to give colleagues a heads up, slides from 1 to 10, And then we are going to jump the slides which come immediately after, and I'm also signaling this to my colleagues here, and you will go to slide number 13 and do slide 13 and 14, and then we will come back to the sequence, please. All right.
Thank you very much, Crane, and once again, good morning, honorable members. My slides will focus mainly on issues around economic growth and the first part that's often regarded as the framing component of the Minister of Finance's presentations to Parliament on the budget days. And the picture there can be summed up in the title of the slide, Steep Economic Downturn and Really Sluggish Recovery. That's the essence of, I think, the economic picture that the minister painted when he presented the budgetary speech or medium-term expenditure framework speech the other day in Parliament. If we take a closer look, a more careful look at the actual pattern or trend of the growth downturn, then what we see is that the growth trajectory has been revised downward for 2017, and this is already a worrying sign, and it has stimulated extensive public debate within the country. The growth moving from the expected growth of 1.3% has now been revised to 0.7% for 2017. Now, this, of course, started out with the recession that began basically in 2016 during the fourth quarter, and it's often in economics accepted that a recession is basically two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. So it started in the fourth quarter of 2016, persisted then until about the second quarter of 2017, and then we had this very, very slow and tedious recovery. But economic growth has never exceeded 2% since 2014, and this is well below, the worrying sign is that this has been very far below the 5.4% GDP growth expected or projected within the National Development Plan in order to meet the national development priorities. Now, if you have a sharp contraction in economic growth, there are a whole host of cascading effects that you have to take into consideration. And here, we are going to limit ourselves to the cascading effects in the domain of fiscal policy. So the first one is your fiscal dreams or your fiscal framework must be adjusted, because slow growth undermines the fiscal framework, essentially. In other words, your spending priorities and your income priorities can no longer be as in the old plan or in the old projections. And then reduced spending and the selective tax increases must now be considered to stabilize, especially the main issue highlighted by the minister, which is the debt-to-GDP ratio. I'll say something more about the debt-to-GDP ratio in a minute or two. What is interesting and what is worrying is the fact that there is an increasing reliance for this sluggish recovery against this gloomy background on very weak sectoral drivers, actually very precarious primary sectors in agriculture and in mining. And these have been the main sectors that have contributed to the stabilization of growth over the last quarter. But we know that these sectors, they are very, very volatile and they fluctuate quite a great deal from quarter to quarter. So can we rely on this as a way to for the economy to pick up over the longer term? And there are serious doubts around that particular proposition. Unemployment, as we know, has basically, the latest figures released at the beginning of this week, repeated the very sad story that 27.7% of the workforce, they are unemployed, and that 30.4 million of people in South Africa live below the poverty line. The country, of course, has not been able to put a dent into its extreme levels of wealth inequality. The next picture reinforces a lot of the key messages coming from that first slide. And this picture is about the real divergence that we are seeing in non-interest spending, which is the top line, and the revenue. This gap
how do you fill this gap between non-interest spending from a budgetary point of view and the limited, the reduced revenue? And the reduced revenue, of course, is a consequence of the slower growth. And it is projected over the medium-term expenditure framework that this slow growth is going to impede the closing of this particular gap. And this is the biggest challenge confronted, that our expenditure priorities are exceeding what we can get from fiscal revenue. It seems, of course, a different way to formulate the same thing. We're living beyond our means. And one way to cover this, of course, is the concern around debt. The debt share of GDP is rising very fast, and this is a very, very big concern. We heard over the news over the last day or two of the rating agencies slipping into the country again. S&P, rating agency experts are all here to come and evaluate and assess what's going to happen, and everybody is anticipating a further rating downgrade. The consequences of that, of course, are severe, and therefore we have to think what are the implications for the February budget. So now the language is beginning to shift and switch from fiscal consolidation to a rise in deficit spending. Now, deficit spending is a word in economic development for all of us who are sort of familiar with the lingua franca of economic development dating back to the 70s, especially the 1980s, when we had a lot of debt downturns in developing countries, is a word that's really seriously raising a lot of concerns within the broader economic fraternity. The fiscal deficit, actually, to close this gap that I've painted in the previous picture, is actually rising, according to the budget, from 3.1% to 4.3%. And the way to cover fiscal deficits is by means of increased borrowing. But increased borrowing is one way of raising another challenge, that your debt service costs will be growing very fast, and has already been isolated as the key expenditure category and crowding out social and economic spending. And so it is this latter part of the minister's statement on debt services which is of particular concern, the crowding out of social and economic spending with the rising levels of debt service costs. And the debt service cost is basically your two levels of the expansion in the debt. The first is the debt to GDP ratio, and this is anticipated to go to 61% from upper 40s a few years ago to 61%, and that is pretty steep. And we sort of veering onto a highly indebted country, and that is of a worrying sign, because it's the consequences for imports, exports, exchange rate instability, they're enormous. So I'm sort of thinking aloud here. But also, the debt service cost as a share of GDP is going to rise very fast, and it is anticipated to be at 15%. And as a budgetary item, we can obviously see the weight there. And this is that very, very hair-raising scenario that is being sketched by this particular picture of your debt service, the debt to GDP ratio just overshooting the anticipated target. The anticipated target is more or less initially was on the black line, but if you go to the 50.7% where you have the fork in the road, as it were, that is where it splits over, and that is the adjustment where you're going over this overshooting of your anticipated debt to GDP ratio. And that is a real, real worrying sign. And the gap, you can see, is really increasing at that after that particular point. So by 2021, we should be at 61% debt to GDP ratio if we carry on the current and present trajectory. Of course, also worrying is this more detailed picture of the interest payments or the debt service cost component of the budget, which is also rising. Now, in this particular context, against this background, what is government planning to do, and what is the context within which the minister is framing his work? There are two levels of interventions from the side of the government. The first is a broader kind of policy level intervention, and the main policy trajectory, even though this is going to be very, very hard to sustain in the current context, is to protect spending on core social programs that benefit poor South Africans. And for that purpose, we have these seven spending priorities outlined in the recent statements, and that is aligned, of course, to the National Development Plan. But however, the question that this is begging is what fiscal space do we have for inclusive economic transformation? Do we have fiscal space for inclusive economic transformation? It reminds me of a report that the World Bank put out around 2012-2014 on the same particular question, and they've investigated and at that time projected that the fiscal space in South Africa is going to be very, very constrained. It's going to be contracting very, very fast. In line with this focus and emphasis on social programs as a priority, the state has also released in the July meeting of the cabinet a 14-point plan, and the purpose of the 14-point plan is to boost confidence and certain microeconomic reforms. And the main purpose, it came in response to the sharp economic downturn and, of course, to counter the recession. The successes of this can only be measured really in the medium term rather than short or immediate term. There has also been a heavy emphasis on what is referred to currently as microeconomic reforms in line with the National Development Plan, and here we find the two areas of focus, basically logistics sector reforms in order to reduce the cost of transportation and import-export at ports. So the first area that is being intervened or considered is the reduction of the cost of electricity, and then, of course, also to consider a whole host of different stimulus packages. More of these will be revealed in the February budget. I'd love to now switch on to the final slide, because this is directly linked to placing the economy on a new trajectory more on long term and dealing with some of the structural constraints or the microeconomic reforms. And this is the area of what is called public investment in infrastructure, networks, and coordination. We understand that the state is still committed to the infrastructure build program, which is running almost at a trillion rands. And this is the overall total over the medium term framework. And this will eventually gobble up or make up 5.9% or 6% of the GDP. Now, the emphasis here is improving the quality of government's infrastructure spending. What does it mean to improve the quality? In other words, it's just not pouring money into infrastructure. But for this purpose, it is a focus on the better planning and the execution of large infrastructure initiatives, and the Public Investment Coordinating Committee and the Budget Facility for Infrastructure. I think these are very, very important initiatives that we have to examine and study very, very carefully in terms of their productive activity. What is, however, disappointing, since the start of the PICC interventions, we have only had 59 projects worth 135 billion in detail. That's in the detailed appraisal phase rather than in the actual construction phase. So how do we close the gap between appraisal phase to actual, bricks and mortar infrastructure? So it seems to be a long and slow process to go from planning into the actual interventions. The economic infrastructure spending, however, via state-owned companies, the SOCs, has come under great scrutiny in recent times. And here, the emphasis has been to fix the patterns of governance in these state-owned companies, because without that, your fiscal and economic risks in these state-owned companies might undermine a very, very lucrative and large-scale intervention in infrastructural spending or commitment. There is also, in the domain of infrastructure, heavy emphasis on fiscal planning for rapid urbanization, which, of course, is laudable, and three areas of work there, I think, require further and closer analysis, but I think we can take up further in the discussion. The first emphasis is on cities and towns as engines of growth, of economic growth, and that is really, I think, a laudable development, because these are really at the coal face of where economic growth and development is actually taking place. And then also adjustments and revisions to the integrated urban development framework, and then the city support program. And government support and investment in these areas, they augur well for the overall infrastructural program, especially at the coal face, in other words, where it affects communities more directly. So this is where I'll sort of hand over to the rest of my colleagues.
Thank you, honourable members. I will be continuing with the theme of promotion of economic growth, but focusing specifically on research and development and innovation. Just in case you are lost, we've gone back two slides. I'm talking to slides 11 and 12. Okay, as indicated, with the retraction of the economy and increasing unemployment, basically research and development expenditure, particularly by the business sector, has been in the decline in real terms. Business expenditure on research and development in any given year tends to follow a cyclical pattern, whereas it rises on occasion when the economy is doing well, but also declines whenever there is a recession. The expenditure is influenced by a number of activities, which include, among others, fluctuations in the GDP, as well as government funding and industry structures. So what governments normally do is that they follow a non-cyclical pattern in terms of funding of research and development, so that even when there is a recession, the funding is maintained at reasonable levels. This is particularly true when it comes to government expenditure on research and development in the science council sector and higher education. However, government funding for business research and development has declined substantially from 23% in 2005 to 6 financial year to now about 5.4% of the following year, in 2014-15. So basically what this is suggesting is that there has been a decline in expenditure on experimental development by firms, private firms, from something like 62% in 2005 to 6 to 36.9% in 2014-15. Why is research and development by firms important? It is because it normally leads to the improved production of goods and services. On a positive note, there is more research and development expenditure on applied research, which is an indication of potential innovation and contribution to knowledge in future. But basically, together, these trends have implications for policy attempts to stimulate and support business innovation. A critical policy question is, how can government promote this counter-cyclical funding for private sector research and development? And the possible answer could be through tax incentives. But the trend suggests that there's a need to review all the existing funding instruments so that new ones can be identified. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We're going to move on to slides 15 and 16, heading education. I'm going to talk to, first of all, vote 14 in the statement read by the Minister, and to vote 15. Vote 14 relates to basic education, and I'm going to pay attention there to the issues of our policy success with respect to workbooks and textbooks. And then raise a concern about infrastructure development spending. And then I'm going to talk about just these challenges that we have now in distributing our funding between higher education and TVETs, and make the argument there that we need to take a holistic view here to be ensuring that TVET funding moves as significantly in terms of its receipts as has higher education itself. Thanks, Peter. So let's start off with the textbooks and the workbooks. So the first point to make, colleagues, is to say that it's really important in the report to see that the Department of Basic Education is reporting the 100% distribution of workbooks to all schools. I mean, that's a really important development that has happened. And we think that the Department of Basic Education should be congratulated on this intervention. We found, however, in the work that we do, and so this is not information that would previously have been available, we found that having a workbook and having a textbook, access to a textbook, makes a real difference to achievement. And this comes out of our TIMSS studies, where we show quite clearly that when people have textbooks and workbooks, and it's the middle line there in that slide, colleagues, relating to grade 9 learners. We say that grade 9 learners scored 24 points higher for maths and 31 points higher for science than those who did not have a textbook. So that's a really important point to make. In some subjects, there are still problems. In KwaZulu-Natal, for example, only 42% of learners reported having a science textbook. Teachers reported improved availability of resources for the teaching of math, and that has an impact on the quality of learning that is taking place. And so we're asking for continued investment in structured learning materials. That's the significance of that particular point. And asking the Appropriations Committee to be putting pressure on our colleagues in government to emphasize the importance of the availability of these structured learning materials. Thank you. The next slide is about the relationship of affordances, if you like, resources that children have in their homes and in their schools. So what we're wanting to say is that there's a clear, and you can see it in these graphs here, there's a clear profile of children in poorer schools not having the same levels of resourcing and provision that children who come out of fee-paying and independent schools might have access to. So we want to emphasize the point that home and school matters. They matter. And that learners from low-income households go to under-resourced schools, so being poor and going to a poor school simply compounds their deprivations. This graph, or this set of figures here is really important because we're wanting to acknowledge that the situation has improved since 2003, but there still remains a major resource gap between children attending no fee schools and those coming from homes with which are much better resourced. So we'd like to make the point that the money is allocated for the school's infrastructure project should be used urgently and immediately for school improvements. The point that we are making is that the school in some ways needs to compensate for the circumstances in which our children find in their homes. We are not going to be able to make provisions for people's domestic and home circumstances, but we can do something about the schools to which these children are going. And so our plea here is that the resourcing of these lower quintile schools is an urgent priority. We move on now to post-school expenditure. And what this graph shows here, and this is the major point here, is that the bulk of our expenditure for post-school expenditure goes to the universities. And what we are suggesting here is that we need to have a whole of the post-school education and training sector in mind, and not only the university sector. As this graph illustrates here, the level of support and funding which is going to the universities, plus what you would like to also understand has gone to NSFAS, privileges the university sector in ways that are problematic. I think the point that we're wanting to make here is that, and this takes us to the next slide here, is that for the economy to grow, we have to be paying far more attention to levels of skill outside of higher education. The production of skill levels in the TVETs is, we would like to argue, absolutely crucial for providing the engine room for growing our economy. Now, this is a really, in many families, a very difficult decision, because what remains in people's minds is that social mobility, the development of capacity, raising of people's well-being is only going to come through going to university. And we're wanting to make a contribution to turning that situation around. The important point to make about these enrollments here, colleagues, is to say that since 2010, we've seen the growth in enrollments in the university sector of almost 100,000. Now, this table here by itself is helpful, but it doesn't give you the full sense of what has happened since 1994. Since 1994, the growth in enrollments in this particular sector has been 264%. In 1993, there was something like 190,000 students in our system. Today we have 970, almost a million. The growth has been absolutely phenomenal. And it's that particular reality that I think that is part of the dynamic and the sociology of what's going on inside of the universities at the moment. That sector has grown largely around this sociological shift that has happened inside of the universities. Now, the growth in the TVET registrations since 2010 is not bad. It's gone up from 358,000 in 2010 to 540,000 in 2017. And what we are saying here, colleagues, is that we have the infrastructure in place to be able to support the TVET sector. I'll be making comments in a moment about completion, but the infrastructure is there. We have in place inside of the country the capacity to be able to increase in that particular space. Thank you. What is not happening, however, and we pay a lot of attention to university throughput and completion rates, but we don't know so well, or equally well, how completion and success are unfolding inside of the TVET sector. So in 2014, in the university sector, we had 185,000 completers, and of these, 30% were in science technology, science, engineering and technology, 27% were in business, and 43% in humanities. Those proportions, I think everybody in the country understands that, are not ideal. We need to have far more registrations in the humanities. I beg your pardon, in science and technology. But it's really the issue here, which is less known about our completers in the TVET sector. There were only at NCV 4 level in 2014 only 7,400 completers. And the whole country produced at that level of skill, and we're talking here about essential crafts, plumbers, electricians, and so on. We're only able to produce 7,400 in that year, and the number is when you think about where we are needing to go, is absolutely shocking. It was slightly better when you talk about NATED, we produced 24,000. But the point that we need to be making is that we now need concentrated attention on this TVET sector. If we're going to be holding our higher education and training ministry to account, it's around all of this. We need a plan here. We need a plan for how to move out of this logjam in which we find ourselves. The last slide, colleagues, is about NSFAS funding. And the big point to make there is that, and this is largely in response to the fees must fall situation, but it raises this big question of where do you put your money? The major point to be making here is that we increased the NSFAS budget. Now, we're not saying that it shouldn't be done. We increased the NSFAS budget from 8.5 billion in 2013, and it went up to 15.2 billion in the 2017 year. The point that we're wanting to make in relation to that is that the bulk of this money is going to students in the universities. This money is privileging university students to a quantum of five times that of what is going to TVET students. So there's an issue there. And this is part of this point we're making of we must come up with a plan here for this particular sector. The last point that we want to make here is that the recovery, the returns, the paying back of students who get NSFAS is still far too low. The recovery around that will help us, and we need to find ways in which to be improving how we get young people, and there is a discussion going on at the moment, who are going into employment, how those young people could be much more systematically paying back this money that they received. It's a complex question inside of the country, given how dependent families are on these students' incomes and so on. But this money is also required to be able to support the students who are still coming in the pipeline. So there are major issues of efficiency, here, colleagues. I'll stop there and hand over to Professor Reddy. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We've got a few comments to make on health, because there wasn't much detail in this budget. So what we've seen that is spending on the social sector will not be adjusted, and is expected to grow. which is good news, I guess. And two-thirds of that spending is on socioeconomic rights types issues. But if we look at the allocation of the $948 billion for infrastructure, this includes some health infrastructure as more hospitals are needed, particularly at the teaching hospital level, and rehabilitation of existing infrastructure. We won't go into training of medical students, nurses, and other allied professionals, which should also happen. But in terms of what this budget said, there was very limited information on detail. I guess we'll wait again for the February budget to listen to the detail on that. For instance, in the last budget, a statement reference was made to the establishment of the NHI fund. And unfortunately, it was silent. This budget was silenced on that NHI fund. And this is really, really important because the NHI is an investment in health, if you look at it from another perspective. And it's a critical transformative program, and it should really not be dropped from the priority list. And we would urge this committee to keep the pressure to continue with this work. It's also important to look after the health of the economy, but just as importantly, it's important to look after the health of the workforce. And if we look at the burgeoning diseases, we've got TB, HIV, and now NCDs, which are posing this major, major threat on the development of the skills that are needed for the economy and the continuation of these skills. And things like NCDs resulting in early death, which means you lose your economically viable sector of the population. This time it might be... Could you move the slide up a bit, please? Okay, I'll read from my one then. It might be important at this time to enhance implementation of innovative ways for funding health. And one innovative way, which we've been talking about for the last 15 years, is the use of taxes. For example, recommendations were made a while ago on how tobacco taxes can be used, but now we're looking at other sin taxes, including the recent sugar tax that's being talked about. Next slide. So if we look at the risks here, we look at significant investments in all sectors, subject to improvement in the economy, obviously, and the figures are right there with the low growth rates. There are competing funds, and this is what puts the NHI at risk in a big way, is the competing funds for the fees must fall versus that for NHI. And it's very difficult to see how all these competing needs are going to be achieved by 2020. So this calls for smart spending to ensure that the limited funds that are allocated are used both efficiently and effectively. And this needs improved governance within both the primary healthcare re-engineering program, but also to look at how the NHI is moving ahead, or in some instance, perhaps not ahead. Wasteful expenditure, I don't need to say more on that. The burden of disease, particularly on NCDs, is definitely on the rise, in addition to the already existing TB, HIV epidemic. And so you've got these three diseases, so people surviving from being treated for HIV and TB are now being burdened with NCDs, and this threatens the lives of many, many people and has a devastating effect on the workforce. And if it has a devastating effect on the workforce, that just filters down to children, to the household, and the home. Thanks.
The issues of local government are very critical, especially when you talk about the appropriations. We also need to understand when the money has been allocated to local government sector, and we try by all means to put it on check against the Constitution, especially Section 152 of the Constitution, that the local government should make a significant impact in the translation of the quality of the lives of the society through the issues of service delivery. So what we are bringing forth is that local government issues cannot be overlooked as a very important sphere of local government, and the issues around responsive and developmental local government is critical, and that's why we put a clock there, that every time the clock is ticking, but the question is that do we have that responsive local government? And as I'm moving on the slide 28, reflecting and appreciating that the trajectory of local government post-1994, the characteristics of service delivery shifts, we also understand that from that time and where we are, there is a population increase, but we need to also recognize that local government need to revamp or match to that standard of the capacity of the population to respond through service delivery mechanisms. And you can appreciate that about 2.26 million annual increase of the population need to resonate with the accelerated service delivery. And currently we have some kind of challenges, especially in the metros and in rural municipalities where service delivery matters most. And therefore, the issue of repositioning is not like we are saying let's start things afresh, but we consolidate the successes and able to reposition the local government. And we know on slide 29 that there were attempts that we made, Project Consolidate, that tried to incubate the municipalities which are not vibrant, but that needs to be enhanced with the Project Consolidate. Another strategy that came very aggressively was the turnaround, of local government. And where we are, we are simply talking back to basics. Where have we missed the point? And therefore, I think that appreciate that the local government space needs more attention. We may not necessarily call for the increase, but to see how these appropriations are spent optimally so that we can able to make an impact in the society. Because the Auditor General of South Africa still put a dipstick on local government, especially on the spends. And you can able to see that most of the municipalities are wanting, especially when we're talking about expression of the audit opinion. And that, to us, is a cause for concern, that we need to see how the whole ecosystem of local government need to be repositioned, because of the characterization of the issues of political interference, capability deficit, weak financial management, lack of accountability, and inadequate revenue base. And revenue base, as you know, most of the municipalities are struggling to collect the revenue there. The instrument of collecting that revenue is critical, and that's why we have high level of debt, indebtedness in that situation. And lastly, but not the least, we actually saying, let's now started looking at the important repositioning outcomes. What will come out of this repositioning that we're talking about? That we need to able to have to dynamize local government and have a dynamic strategy that enhance capacity and be responsive, and a blueprint, best practices locally, internationally, that we can able to roadmap, you know, the local government, in line with the national development plan. And I think that that connect is critical so that we can able to domesticate the current sustainable development goals. And that resonate with a powerful trajectory of a developmental local government. And in that way, that will also mean that the integrated development plans need to be aligned and to have an inclusive, sustainable local government. And all when all of this are done through a so-called a phase-in approaches, and that process would have to go even through the cabinet level for rollout. And I think this is what we need to talk about. We just also appreciate that HSRC has done a number of research in local government, and I will not go through the list, but what we are currently where we are, we have just completed a very important research on Vuani, and which we are planning how to release that, because that defined, you know, that case study defined how the issues of community engagement and democracy, you know, play itself out, and we need to get the message out of the story of Vuani at a glance, and issues of support programs of the National Treasury needing to come into the space, SAGA, local government, CETA, as well as COPTA are at a play which have actually endorsed this reposition of local government.
Honourable members, it's always interesting to start talking about social cohesion when it comes to spending money. But Minister Gigaba said that there might be some moral backsliding when it comes to the receipts of tax recently. He spoke about that alongside the fact that there are some SARS inefficiencies in collection. But why would a citizenry not want to pay their taxes? Why would they begin to hide their taxes? And I think this issue of social cohesion and nation building is really important. When people begin to lose trust in government, they tend to start withholding money from the fiscus. When they start feeling insecure in a country, they start withholding money from the fiscus. So in a sense, it's something that I think is really important to talk about, and yet it isn't one of the seven priorities that the minister laid out in the in his speech last month, this notion of social cohesion. So when it comes to things like dealing with issues of racism and redress, the next slide, please, social protests, violence and crime in our country, that certainly is a priority area. But what are the things that we could be doing as an appropriations committee? What might you be doing in order to encourage these notions of social cohesion in our country? Because we believe that that actually helps us to address the growth priorities and the fiscal objectives that we have as a country. I don't need to remind you of the inequalities. We've spoken about it as we've gone through our presentation, and certainly the minister has spoken about it all the way through. But a life expectancy difference of 20 years between black and white South Africans, an unemployment difference fourfold between black and white South Africans, university enrollment, seven times as many white South Africans proportionately are enrolled at university compared to black South Africans. Household income, we hear that figure fairly well. The Human Development Index, South Africa is 116th out of 200 countries, but if you disaggregate it for white South Africans, 15th. So where are we with issues around redress in our country, and how does that contribute to the fiscus? So white South Africans understand that these inequalities are unacceptable, but are quite reluctant to want to do anything about them. This data that I'm talking about comes from the South African Social Attitude Study that the HSRC does every year. And just recently, we asked about restitutive actions. What is the appetite of South Africans for restitutive actions, for redress? Now, most worrying is that most people want to forget the past and move on. So two-thirds a few years ago. Now, if you disaggregate it between black and white South Africans, 51% of black South Africans want to forget the past and move on, 76% of white South Africans. More white South Africans are saying, can't we just move on? But we know that the inequalities in our country are so vast that we really can't just move on. So some of the questions that we were asking in these social attitude questions were around a voluntary restitution a fund or even a restitution or wealth tax. What is the appetite for a wealth tax in South Africa? And if you look at one of the second last point on that slide, 43% of black South Africans, the vast majority of our country, but only half of them are in favor of a wealth or restitution tax. But most worryingly, only 8% of white South Africans. And that for me says that we need to do a lot more work on social cohesion and nation building. We need to regain a vision of what our country can be. And I think one of the things that I've noticed was missing in the midterm budget speech was to make sure that arts and culture has got funding for the initiatives that they set up around community dialogues, around sport and recreation. No matter how much we know that things like World Cups and whatnot cost, they also bring together people from walks of life, which is a soft fund, but with enormous benefits. And if we look at the trajectories over the years of how trust in each other, trust in government, changes when we have big national events, they do. So I'm never in favor of soft spend that's wasted, but frequently we need social cohesion events that will help us in effect make people more willing to contribute to the fiscus and also tighten their belt. Because I think when we start thinking about raising taxes in any form, if we have a vision of what the future may hold, people are more likely to want to participate in that. So that for me is really important. And then the other thing that I wanted to say is that when we speak about things like hate speech, now you'll excuse the language, I did put in some dots and dashes, but a little while ago, around the student protest, there was students who spray-painted F white people on walls, T-shirts and whatnot. We asked in our survey what should happen to people who had those sentiments. Now, the good news is that 81% of our country thinks that that should stop. So there isn't a huge groundswelling of racial hatred, but here's the thing that I want to draw to attention. It could become something that foments more protest, more action, more revolution, I suppose. 2% of our country thinks that people who write those things should be praised. Only 2%. But 13% say that nothing should happen to people like that. And certainly some of the sociologists that I read say that there comes a tipping point. You don't need half of the country to have these attitudes. You just need 15 or 20%, and it can become something that rolls over into ongoing social protest and increased racial disharmony. And I think that for me is really important, that our spend on practices that promote social cohesion, we shouldn't exclude it while we're doing all of the hard things that my colleagues has spoken about. The last comment I want to make is also from a research study that we've just concluded, and it's waiting for the Department of Higher Education and Training to sign off, and that is this notion. We followed a whole lot of students through their university education for 5 years. And what we were looking at, of course, was how they coped financially. We looked at how they coped academically. And also we looked at who were able to complete within time and whatnot. So this goes back to what my colleague has spoken about in terms of TVET and higher education. And the thing that we came up with, we know that the HEAR report, I actually can't pronounce that, will talk a lot about the financial recommendations and what we've seen in the media this past week. There is a call for increased TVET funding. But what else can we be doing for higher education to ensure that we have better completion rates and better social support for students? And for me, that's one of the things that I think is really important for this committee, is that even if we start putting money into TVET, the one thing that we could put money in higher education, even if it's not free education, it could be a framework for student support. There currently isn't a framework, a national framework for student support in higher education, which I find quite amazing. There is a framework for student support in TVET. Now, what that means is that students are struggling with completion rates, with mental health problems, with health problems, with those issues of racism and institutional bias that they speak about during the protests. But there isn't a national program for student support. Now, the Statistician General just last week said, as our CEO has mentioned, that we have almost 1 million students in higher education in a system that was developed for 500,000 students. Now, it tells us that if we had less students in higher education, more in TVET, we could also possibly provide more support for students in higher education. We would have less student protests, we'd have better completion rates. We'd also be able to take a framework for student support and ensure that it's implemented. Now, it won't be a popular choice to put money into student support rather than student fees, but in the end, it could have a long-term gain. And that's certainly some of our research over the last 5 years, where we think there's something to be said about putting money into a particular piece of higher education that may have gains beyond that investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We come towards the end now, and this is essentially a summary of the slides of the note that we wrote to you earlier this month about the risks that are confronting us. And the first question that we posed in framing our reply to you is to ask the question, are public resources being allocated in an optimal way to foster growth economically and socially? And I'd like to emphasize the difference there between those two terms that we are using there, economically and socially. So a lot of our attention has been focused on economic growth. We're saying here that we also need to think about social growth and to change the language that we have been using, dominated by, excuse my comment here to my economist colleagues, but our language is dominated by the interests of the economists. And we need to be thinking much more broadly beyond economics to understand how it is that we need to be managing our resources. That takes us to this whole set of dilemmas which I think that we are having to confront. And as I raise those 4 points, I'm not always going to come on the side of the social, but to say that we need to be thinking much more carefully about this balance between the social and the economic. And the first question arises in relation to the balance between our investment in economic infrastructure versus our expenditure on social services how we're dealing with that. The observation to make here is that our expenditure on economic infrastructure has gone down and our expenditure on social services has gone up. Now that, of course, raises a complexity in relation to the point that I'm making about the social and the economic. The second question relates to our spending on maintenance as opposed to our expenditure on repair, a new infrastructure. What has happened in the last while is that we have seen a decline in the allocations to maintenance. And you can see this in the ways in which traveling around our country, the very fabric of our structures, our facilities, is not ideal. And it raises this question about our capacity to be able to build new things and to keep them in a state which is not only usable but optimal. The penultimate question there is asking the question of our understanding, our analytic, if you like, monitoring and evaluation of the impact of the financial commitments that we make. Do we have a good, and this is what we're asking for, do we have a good cost-benefit framework for coming to understand the impact of our spending? And the last point that we want to be saying is that where could we be saving money? Where could we in this country, in this environment, could we be effecting savings in a way which would allow us to be allocating money to where it is much more urgently needed? And in our response to you, Chairperson, we did raise the question about the number of ministries. And we're being provocative here, and we're saying we have too many ministries. We could be looking at reducing those ministries. We have a great deal more than we had in the past. Next slide comes back to this question of whether we are using our resources properly. And we're asking here in relation to that whether it is not time now to develop for ourselves a checklist of things on which we should not be spending, as opposed to our priorities. Do we have a sense of a list in which our money should not be going? And we're urging that we take that route of identifying non-essential spending. Next slide, please. Towards mitigating and managing these risks, we're suggesting here that the level of reporting from the SOEs be dramatically improved. If we are going to bail out SOEs, we're saying that we need the kind of information which shows us a whole lot more how accountability, how reporting lines have been implemented, and why those lines of reporting and accountability are not working. And we are saying that we should be insisting on conditions, much more stringent conditions. When we do have bailouts, there must be much more stringent conditions attached to what those bailouts are all about. As far as higher education and vocational education is concerned, we've raised those, and I won't go back to that at all. The last but one slide is about salaries. So we know how in the public sector the practice of freezing posts is one of the most important means by which we save on our salary bill. We're saying yes, that's an important strategy which needs to be continued, but we need to have a much better sense of what the losses and the gains are when we don't fill posts. We need to have a much clearer analytic approach to understanding what the risks are when posts are not filled. Are there possibilities that the filling of key posts could make improve efficiencies and help us improve our fiscal situation? And then we that point about the tax credits is simply saying when we develop these tax regimes, should we not be, if we're wanting to increase the allocation which is going to go to the NHI, removing the tax credits that we give people in their tax returns now. The last slide, colleagues, simply highlight these points, highlight the issues that were raised by Peter next door to me about what the risk of a downgrade is. I would simply like to echo and emphasize what Peter said in relation to the dangers of going into that territory, of being in a space where we are going to be confronted with servicing the debt becoming one of the major items of our GDP. I mean, the fact of, and this is a situation that many African countries are going through, where their major allocation out of their budget on an annual basis is to servicing debt. For us to find ourselves in that situation is, I think, a major tragedy. That we should be pouring money in a direction which results in the flight of resources from the country to the metropoles is a problem. That money could much better be spent inside of the country. So this danger of a downgrade needs to be explained and emphasized in the public education that we and you undertake. We need to be helping the country understand simply what the dangers and the ways in which we are going to struggle to come out of a situation like this once it is upon us. And so the last point to make, Chairperson, is about where we could be going and what we could be doing. So we're saying there, and it's the second last point, how can government spending prioritize selective projects to stimulate economic growth and development in lagging regions? This is the major question. I mean, and I think this is the criticism that was leveled at Minister Gigaba. There wasn't a plan. And we're wanting to, if you like, support that criticism and say we need a plan. We need to be coming up here with ways in which we are much more clearly helping ourselves understand how we come to meet the objectives that we set in our national development plan. What's the plan for getting us out of the situation in which we find ourselves? And I'd like to stop on that note, Chairperson. Thank you.
Honourable members, we now have received the briefing by Human Sciences Research Council on their analysis of the 2017 medium-term budget policy statement. My observations is that you listened carefully. I would now want to open the floor for clarity-seeking questions. You could also move on to interrogating the briefing. Over to you. Honourable Member Shopestole.
Thanks, Chairperson, and thanks for the briefing. I have got many questions, but I want just to ask one thing for now. That your institution, is it possible to help us with identifying those items that we should not be spending on? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Relevant question. Honorable Member Gwabaza.
Let me start by making this observation, Chairperson, and perhaps propose that, in fact, the HSRC does become explicit on the subject. You don't seem to be saying to us quite in very clear terms, where are we in terms of our fiscal policy? And in your view, what should be the fiscal policy stance going forward that should get us out of this current situation? Couple that with the monetary policy in very clear terms. I raise this question because, you know, institutions like yourselves who do research, who are specialists in these subjects, should be advising us in very clear terms on those two issues, the fiscal and monetary policy. We are in a very tight situation, a very precarious economic situation. And we rely on experts like yourselves to be very upfront with us and be clear. Direct us also to new economic thought on these subjects. Don't just tell us about, you know, what has been applied and might have succeeded in some countries and failed in other countries. What is the emerging economic thought on these subjects? And direct us to some empirical evidence of that. Let me give you an example. The U.S., for it to get out of the global financial crisis, did a combination of fiscal and monetary policy to get out of that situation, and now they are, and as a result, they were able to balance things like inflation, interest rates, with job increases, and therefore moved out of that situation. Unlike what the Euro region largely did, as they were facing both the global financial crisis and the domestic sovereign debt in a number of the Euro countries. Give us an idea of where we are and where we should be going in terms of those things. You're rather too cautious in your approach to these things, and don't be too cautious because look, you are a reputable institution, and we consult you because we believe in your research work and we trust in your research. And we trust your advice. You are dealing with a committee which eventually must advise Parliament how to allocate funds to department and for what purpose. And where we sit, the purpose should be on better spending, on stimulating growth and turning the situation around. Can't be business as usual. And therefore, these two policies cannot continue as in the past. Let me just look at my slides, Chairperson.
How many more questions?
Are you allowing us 3, 4, 5 questions, Chairperson? Okay, thanks. Yes. If you could also just indicate to us where, in terms of the debt, indicate to us the level of the rand-dominated debt versus the dollar-dominated debt. I sometimes think, Chairperson, that, and I don't know, it's a layman's thinking, that when you have a debt, it should be possible to balance between servicing your debt and paying the principal debt. Because if your expenditure is focused on servicing the debt, there is no way you are going to eventually get rid of that debt. So what are we doing exactly, and should we actually be doing that? If we are not doing it, servicing the debt with one hand and cutting down on the principal debt with another hand. Because the threat is just too big. On slide 11, Chairperson, I'm is it my fourth? That should be coupled with slide 12. I'm just curious. You are saying that government funding of business research and development declined, and so on. And you are then talking about the tax incentives being, you know, one of those instruments that could assist research in the private business, and I, again, it's a layman's thinking. Why would private business be dependent on government funding to fund research on how they should be improving their operations, their investments, and innovation in their business? Obviously, government is interested in business creating jobs and you know, growing the economy, because that in fact is their primary task. But shouldn't we be saying there must be joint exercise in this thing, and more of it coming from business, because they are making profit. And in fact, there have been a lot of incentives government has been giving to businesses. My sense as well is that those incentives have simply assisted private businesses to maintain their businesses and to sustain existing jobs, and very little goes into creating new jobs. But again, that's a layman's reading of the situation. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me first welcome the presentation. Chairperson, I have also four questions. The first one is with regard to the analysis that have made by you on slide 4, 5, and 7. We have outlined briefly analysis of the current economic situation. But what I wanted to find out, what are the concrete interventions does you propose to ensure that the economy is brought back to its fast growth trajectory? That's the first question. The second issue, Chairperson, is with regards to the risk. Is on slide 26, where we are mentioning those risks, but you have indicated that wasteful expenditure at all levels, you don't want to talk about it, but we need you to talk about it. The study on Vuyani, you seem to be very excited about it. I'm sure there are lesson that we are going to get from it. When is it going to be out? And can we, as this committee, be provided with that study when it is out? The last one, Chairperson. It's with regards to the higher education. The results that you have showed us with regards to the pass rate of the TVET that is not satisfactory. I don't get it where it is as of now, but what I wanted to find out, what is the cause of this in your own research? You need to give us a tangible outcomes of why are we having this situation that we are having as of now. Thank you.
Honourable Member Snukwanyane.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. I think the one question that I wanted to ask my colleague has asked with regard to the funding for research, because I was also going to just ask what you see the role of the private sector generally in terms of contributing towards that, but I won't be going to that one. My one question that I would like to ask is with regard to TVET colleges. A lot of this information we are aware of because I think it's one area where we have serious problems. Not just that students don't, less students go to TVET colleges than universities. This culture of universities is just continuing. But the other thing that we have around this, okay, is the funding, is the numbers, but what about the quality? Have you perhaps ventured into the area of the quality? Because this is one of the things that keeps coming up, that the quality of training that they get at the TVET colleges is very inferior, and a lot of them are not employable. Is this an area where you think we are spending money wisely, appropriating money to these TVET colleges? I want to jump some of them. And then the next one that I would like to just check with you, you know, the issue of sugar tax, sin tax, and all those other taxes that that we are trying to promote in order to promote our economy. I know some of these taxes, like the sin tax and all that, have been in place. In your opinion, do you find that these are, this is really working? Because I think these, especially this sin tax of cigarettes and alcohol and all that, and what have you found? Do you think that it's making any impact so far? Not that I'm against it, but I just would like to know from yourselves, because you are doing research, whether you see, because from where I stand, I think that people will just continue doing what they always do without worrying about the economy of the country. They'll spend on that rather than spend on food and all that for their families. Oh, the other thing then that I wanted to, I would like to speak to is the issue of staffing, which we have correctly mentioned that staffing, there is this policy that vacant posts should not be filled, and which actually is a noble idea, but at the same time it does compromise departments. You find that at times people will not fill a critical post, because if you are told that if there's a vacant post, don't fill it in order to. And I think we really need, what would you think is the best way to do this? Because yes, we want to reduce, but what happens in the process is that critical posts then are lost. But perhaps if you look at the top heavy structures that we have, because I think that is one thing that has been coming up quite a lot, that we have top heavy structures in our departments, because you know, if you look at the number of employees, it's just been growing and growing and growing over the time. So what would be your take when it comes to that one? Yeah, that is one thing. Which one else? Okay, the fourth one, because we're supposed to have four. I just want to comment on this issue of racism and attitudes. You know, after 1994, all of us were excited when we thought things were really moving in the right direction, and we could see the rainbow nation happening right in front of our eyes. And I think even, or just on Facebook, you can see that now the racism is coming back. On a day-to-day basis, there are so many cases of racism, and I think you put it very nicely. I mean, I like the way you've put it, because I am aware, but the way you've put it, it worries me even more that we really are moving backwards. So I think, like one of my colleagues was saying, what would be your take on this one? You know, in most of these things, just if you can give us some recommendations. I know you can't just answer it all by yourselves, but what do you think about this racism and these attitudes that we're going, because it means we're moving three steps backwards now after moving forward. Yeah, I'll stop the chair for now.
Now, infrastructure development and planning is a cornerstone to ignite economic growth and create employment. Besides the PICC and budget facility on infrastructure introduction, what are other concrete proposals by HSRC that you could put forward to strengthen the intergovernmental relations and coordination at an administrative level to improve infrastructure development and planning? Now, in basic education, the policy and function of scholar transport remains a challenge.
and there's no standard practice for the implementation in all 9 provinces. Some implement the program through provincial public works, while others through provincial basic education or transport. Some of the challenges in this program include non-payment of contractors within 30 days. As a result, some of the scholar transport vehicles have been repossessed by the banks as due to non-payments. What proposals is HRC putting forward to address this possible solution, because other alternative solutions, because the solution is in paying within 30 days, but it has not happened. But what could be the alternative solutions? I will now hand over to you, sir, to lead us in the responses.
Thanks very much for those very insightful questions, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee for raising those questions. We're not going to be able to answer all of the questions, but we will do our best. Let me kick off with the response to Honourable Member Shope Sitole raising this question about things we should not be spending on. I'm not able to answer your question straight away, but we can certainly begin a discussion, Chairperson, with the Appropriations Committee about how we might do this. It is, I think, an interesting area to be applying our minds, and I would like us to rise to the challenge to answer you. I'm going to ask Peter to start taking the questions that Honourable Member Mbasa has raised about our cautiousness and our and not telling you explicitly what the desired wisdom should be here for getting ourselves out of this hole here, and to ask Peter if he can start this conversation, and some of us will want to come to also add to what you may have to say. Please, Peter.
Thank you, Graeme, and thanks, Honourable Members, for those very interesting and very thought-provoking questions. I think the questions are all taking us on the right path in having a very, very constructive discussion and debate on all these different areas. So if, for example, we would love to identify items on which we should not spend, the source for that, I think, would be a useful source where we should begin would be the Auditor General Report, because that would provide us with very concrete evidence of areas where there are red flags around spending. But if you want to have, I think, a comprehensive political economy or deep economic answer to that, we have to begin with a comprehensive and coherent framework. And from that framework, we have to develop a set of criteria that we would then have to utilize to evaluate and assess every one of the elements. In other words, going beyond the Auditor General Report to a more coherent economic discussion. And that will, of course, keep us busy for the whole day. I wouldn't love to sort of take up all the time on that front. I'd love to move on to the cautiousness around fiscal policy and monetary policy, and specifically in the area of the extent to which we can copy models and frameworks utilized elsewhere in the world in countries where they have been in economic dire straits or predicaments, and the extent to which that can assist and help us. I'll try and be very brief and to the point. Firstly, South Africa is not the only country finding itself in this particular situation of an economic downturn. In fact, a lot of our BRICS country partners find themselves in, have been going through the same, as well as the so-called MINT countries. I'm sure colleagues are familiar with this acronym MINT. Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, Turkey. So if you look at the MINT countries, there is internationally a great comparison that's being drawn between the BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and the MINT countries. The MINT countries, they're supposed to be the second layer or the new layer of countries who should be sort of stepping in to the void of development that's left open, or the new emerging economies. Now, if we look at Turkey and Brazil specifically, these two countries have been in economic dire straits as well over the last couple of years, actually, and Brazil has only recently emerged out of its economic dire straits, but it's also been in a very, very vulnerable position, very precarious, and there are new reports over the last 2-3 weeks suggesting that Brazil might be actually sliding back. Turkey's is actually stuck in an economic trap, what we call a low economic trap, and it is also not emerging out of that particular situation. Mexico is similar, and so forth. And in each and one of these countries, you have a variety of different reasons and causes for the economic dire straits that they find themselves in. And so why is it that I keep on insisting on the BRICS and the MINT? It is because it is very hard for us to copy the quantitative easing methodologies and frameworks utilized in both United States, the advanced European bloc, as well as the more struggling Southern European countries. Of course, the Southern European countries here we have to use in inverted commas, because Ireland experienced similar problems to the Low Countries, as it's often referred to in Europe. So if we just look at quantitative easing and whether it has really been successful in the United States, yes or no, there are the typical things of what economists say on the one hand and on the other hand, and if you chop the hands off, and then economists don't know what to say. So this is the situation that the United States is finding itself in. The United States is trying to ease its quantitative easing, but it cannot do it because the financial sector is on life support, and that is what quantitative easing basically means. Quantitative easing basically means that you are releasing a huge amount of money into the economy via the financial sector in order to prop up the economy and allow the banking sector to refinance the recessionary wave that you've been in. The challenge in the U.S. is to liquidate that situation. In other words, to change the heavy financial extension into a situation where the banks can repay that money. And what we are finding is that that foundation is actually very soft at the moment, and what we find is that there are prospects of a new bubble going to burst in the U.S. This is the situation, and so the challenge there for us is, do we want quantitative easing that will just create the myth of recovery? And so that's the challenge. So number one, South Africa is not the only country in this particular predicament. Quantitative easing seems to be helping in the United States, but it is really not presenting it with a longer-term solution to its situation. South Africa's situation is not the same as the U.S. because South Africa has got a dual problem. Our current downturn is a recessionary economic contraction, which is economic crisis, but we have a deep structural problem. And this leads me into the other areas that I want to comment on, similar to our BRICS partners. The structural problem is partially being addressed by, I think, a very, very important intervention, which is the PICC. Releasing R1 billion into the economy, or R1 trillion into the economy, in the South African economy, is an enormous investment. It's not a small amount of money for an economy 3.5 to 4 trillion rands worth. That's a massive injection in the economy. And I think, following the Chinese example, China was also in serious economic dire straits, and it started in 2016, in the second quarter of 2016. It lasted until about the end of 2016, and China is slowly recovering. Of course, in the Chinese case, because of their high economic growth rates, they have not fallen into a recession, but the growth rate has contracted from the traditional you know, averages between 7% and 10%, it is now in the lower order of between 7% and 5%, and that is a worrying concern in China and so forth. What the Chinese did, the Chinese implemented something which is similar to you know, exploiting our PICC or massive infrastructural investment. It is on the one side what they call demand stimulation. So there was a release in kind of lowering of interest rates and those measures in order to boost the spending power of the Chinese. At the same time, that was coupled with boosting their infrastructural programs, their infrastructural investment programs. Of course, in the China, the Chinese economy is very oriented towards around the state, so the state still has quite a tremendous amount of power in driving that. And that is why I'm returning to the leverage or the opportunity presented by this massive infrastructural investment. What does the massive infrastructural investment enable us to do? The massive infrastructural investment is, in economic terms, referred to as its benefit cascades via what is called a multiplier effects. Multiplier effects. With the investment by the state, the state is not crowding out other investment, but it's crowding in other investment. Yeah? And that crowding in other investment is actually partially related to why the state has become such an important driver in R&D spending. I mean, this is historical in development, where if we look at the armaments industry, the military industry, if we look at our own Danel and its advances, if you look at the whole host of different programs within DTI, those are nothing but R&D-based or expenditures via the state or incentives being presented by the state to help boost the private sector investment. In other words, state investment to crowd in private investment. And so that's the opportunity that is being presented to us by the PICC, massive $1 trillion pumping into the economy over the MTF. And so for me, it is in that area where we see the most, the biggest change, both at the level of the structural deficits that we've got to we have to counter in South African economy, and it will also at the same time present us with spillover effects into dealing with issues around economic downturns and recessionary slow recovery. But what we have to do, we cannot have a situation that after so many years, we have barely been able to spend $160 billion of this huge amount of you know, infrastructural investment. And so this is the area concretely where we have to spend a bit more money. It is very hard for me to present a detailed program, because there has been some work done by the Financial and Fiscal Commission on exploring these possibilities and opportunities. It is much deeper work required to develop a detailed program of the three or four main areas where the PICC must pay attention to. Some of these Crane already presented in risks and areas of attention, but I would call them, from an economist's perspective, the attention to institutional tightness. What we mean by institutional tightness is the state, of course, has a role to steer investment at the level of not only concretely putting money into it, but also refining, tightening, and defining the kind of rules of the game, as it were. In other words, what are the policies, what are the specific kind of pieces of legislation that can help us to drive this investment process so that we can get the maximum amount of return. And so it is in this area, I think, where we have to spend quite a huge amount of attention. And if we can be given a little bit of more time, I think we can invest more in finding out more concretely what kind of programmatic interventions in the institutional domain can help us to boost our PICC expenditure and ensure the bigger multiplier effects for it that it offers us. But that is really a big, big a pool of money and source of funding that we have to change the South African society into a completely new society. And so that is where I'll stop on the first one, but my emphasis is therefore really on getting the structural dynamics right in changing structural dynamics of the South African economy. And it kind of links up to some of the detailed proposals.
Can I say that I think Peter's answered the question, Comrade Chair, on the question about concrete interventions that Honourable Manyana raised. He also addressed this question about the relationship between government expenditure incentivizing private expenditure. But Peter, can you just answer Honourable Member Mbasa's question about the rand denominated versus the dollar denominated debt, please?
Okay, yeah. This is a, I'm sorry that I've written the answer here already. I'm very attracted to the debt issue because of the area that I've been focusing on. Initially, I wanted to be a financial economist, but eventually I turned out to be an economist on land tenure systems. So the debt situation in South Africa is something that you've got to study with great care. We have three levels of debt when we discuss and study the issue of debt. There's public debts, there's private sector debt, there's household debt. These three should not be conflated. And if you want to have a careful understanding of them, I think you should really focus on the specific category of debt. Public debt, of course, is a big issue because of the linkages between public debt and the other two main categories of debt. Very often, household debt seems to be insulated, and household debt tends to be private debt and has its own dynamics. Private sector debt, on the other hand, has become problematic as the as deeper analysis of the quantitative easing situation, of course, would reveal that it has just resulted in the United States of several waves of quantitative easing where the banks, you know, got themselves increasingly into debt and the U.S. government had to release more and more and more funding into these banks. Now, the concern that we have here is public debt. South Africa's public debt has got two components. The one component is what is referred to as historical public debt. Historical public debt in South Africa is largely denominated in dollar or foreign currency. If we have post-apartheid debt, that is denominated quite extensively in rands. Why? Because there's been a lot of changeover in the ability of South Africa to borrow externally, in the latter days of the apartheid period. Now, so why has this changed? So you've got two things that has happened in the South African economy. There has been an extensive development of what is called debt rollover and indebtedness to service past debt servicing that falls due. So what does this mean in layperson's terms? I mean, you're paying Paul and you're borrowing from Peter, essentially. So in other words, your debt doesn't decrease because you're basically trading on debt. And this is the predicament that we're in. So as the service cost of debt increases, we're actually increasing our borrowing in order to repay that servicing without attacking the principal on the debt or the capital value of the debt. So the capital value of the debt is just rolled over. So when you borrow more, you have more people that you actually owe, and so that blows up or inflates the principal or the capital value of the debt with further cascading effects on increasing future borrowing or service costs, as it were. And so this is, South Africa has been fortunate to have three or four bond issues in the last decade or so that were very, very big. Some of them, of course, by the state-owned companies, initiated by Eskom and SAA and so forth, and others very closely linked to this debt servicing. And so we've had a samurai bond and so forth. And then in more recent times, we've been borrowing quite a bit from China, the Chinese government, to, you know, prop up and enable us to pay Paul by borrowing more from Peter. And this is the South African situation and the South African predicament. Now with increasing deficit spending, that first graph I presented, how do you close the deficit? So the closing of the deficit is going to basically result in increasing borrowing. So this is why I'm saying that we're on a debt spiral, and that's the danger that we're in. And so we've got to close up that debt spiral. But once again, the key for generating revenue and resources in the economy is capitalizing on our big infrastructure bonanza that we're spending on. That's a massive investment. The multiplier effects on that can hardly be ignored.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Priscilla, please. Priscilla, can you take Honourable Members Manana's question and also Manana, sorry. My apologies, Honourable Member. Am I excused? Thank you, Chairperson. And Sir Kanyana, Honourable Member's question about sugar tax, please.
Thank you for the very thoughtful question. I think my response will be a response in terms of a broad public health perspective. And let me turn us back to the tobacco taxation, which was the first type of taxation that the South African government engaged in a process of putting into place. And the sugar tax and other sin taxes are actually trying to model on how we did that work. Now, to address your question directly, if you look at how the South African government implemented the tobacco tax, is that the tobacco tax, firstly, South Africa is not the only country that does it, even though we led the movement in doing it and other countries followed. But Canada was ahead of us. Australia and Thailand were also ahead of us. This is part of a comprehensive health promotion or public health effort. So you have health education interventions, you have medical interventions, and you have the taxation mechanism. Now, fortunately for us in South Africa, we do have data that we collected over from 1999 to 2011 among school children to look at the various interventions that we put in. And tobacco taxation was one of the interventions. And this demonstrated two things. It demonstrated a 25% drop in the rate of tobacco use among school children. It demonstrated, how would I put this, sort of positive attitudes to not smoking. And it created a social norm and a culture that smoking was not good for you and had harmful effects to the body and to the environment. So it's not taxation alone necessarily, but it's part of a comprehensive program of action that a government would implement. Also, the tobacco taxation was a program that was put in place for a responsible public health action. And that taxation can be positively used to develop programs such as a health promotion foundation or other activities that can promote prevention. So it's, and the tobacco, the important thing is that tobacco taxation and sugar taxation together and individually would contribute both to the to reducing and preventing the NCD epidemic, the diabetes cardiovascular disease epidemic, as well as infectious diseases, because they're all combined. So yes, there are major gains to implement it. What one would need to look at, and unfortunately we didn't reach our targets in 1999, I don't remember the actual numbers now, but in 1999 we set targets as to what proportion of the actual price of a packet of cigarette would become the tax component, and there was a plan that was put in place that within 5 or 10 years the taxation would make up 80% of the price of the component, of the tobacco component. But unfortunately, that was not implemented. So we fell back a little bit there. But the answer is yes, these taxes do make a difference. Thank you, Professor Lee.
Thank you. The study on Vuani is complete. So we are at the point where we are we're going to do a pre-release by first contacting our stakeholders, and I think this portfolio committee will have the report, and if possible, perhaps just to take you through the report before we hit the waves in the media.
I'd like to raise some issues that, and return to these issues about the TVET's colleagues. It's been raised twice. The question by Honourable Manana, first of all, asked, what's the cause of this, the failure rate inside of the TVET? And then Honourable Member Sakanyana raised the question about, are we spending our money wisely in the TVETs? And my general response here, Chairperson, is to say that we're looking still at downstream challenges inside of the system. So these failure rates, both in the TVET sector and in the university sector, have to do with the levels of preparation which students bring to both their studies at the university and at the colleges. This is the apartheid. This is the apartheid debt here, if you like. You know, we're looking at these long range issues here. And Charlene raised the question of translanguaging. We need to be finding ways in which this almost two grade gap between the performance of our children in the privileged schools and the performance of our children in the lower quintiles 1, 2, and 3, and maybe even quintile 4 schools. The gap between those schools is almost two grades. So that gap persists all the way. By the time these students come in into the TVET system, and you're looking at weaker students academically going into the TVET system than would go into the university system. They're dealing with all of these legacy difficulties that they have had to endure. And we've got to be talking about a concentrated correction in the long term of our schooling system. But in the short term, and there is a problem, and we'll be quite blunt about it, teaching in the TVET colleges is poor. It is, and there is now data around all of this about the need for. So people are talking about decolonization in the higher education system, in the universities. We need a pedagogical renewal to take place in the TVET system. As an absolute priority before we even talk about anything else. I mean, how these young people will come into these colleges for these blocks, for example. They come for 3-4 weeks at a time. They go back to into their context. The relationship between that block period and the context in which they work is minimal. So we're needing to understand a whole lot better how to work with what we've got already in the system. So, I mean, that's my response to that. I'm going to hand over to Charlene to please answer the questions about racism.
Thank you, Crane. And before I do, one of the other things around TVET is that it seems that if some of the students who were currently trying to get into higher education were redirected to TVET, it would increase the pass rates in TVETs because they are stronger students, but they're actually misplaced in the higher education system. So those figures that the statistician general spoke about, we've got 1 million for a system that caters for 500,000, but what we probably need is more like 750,000 students in the higher education system. So there's a whole lot of students that really should be redirected into TVET, but there's an issue of desirability as well. And I think we've spoken about a little bit around this upward mobility aspiration that we have as a country. If you look around the world, people generally are aspiring to lower middle class kind of standard of living. In South Africa, we seem to have an upper middle class standard of living aspiration, which is unrealistic for a country like ours. And I think that's something that we need to also be speaking about in the public domain. From a racism point of view, what should we do? And I think for me here, I believe that we have a very conservative tax regime in this country. If you compare it to other parts of the world, we seem to be very reluctant to increase our levels of taxation, whether it's a sin tax, whether it's individual taxation, whether it's company taxes or, and business taxes. So I think that's something that really must be looked at by this committee because, and I know there have been commissions in the past, but one example that I like to draw attention to is in Germany, after reunification, there was a 20-year, what they called solidarity tax. It was time-limited, everybody paid it, and it went into particular projects for changing, upskilling of education systems and job creation and also infrastructure. Now, some of the research that we're showing is showing that people don't have a huge appetite for those kinds of taxes, but it doesn't mean that they won't pay it or that they would be tardy in actually delivering it. And that could be something that we could look forward to. Because the way that we change our racism issues is not so much as dealing with the problem of outbursts, but it's trying to make sure that people have different standards of living and they're brought into a public space where they can have dignity. And I think that's really important. So I think we need some symbolic acts, and I think just this last week, you know, the issues around Black Monday and the old South African flag, I think we really need to start clamping down symbolically on any issues of racism, and I think the Human Rights Commission and criminalizing hate speech, those kinds of things, are going somewhat towards addressing that. But we also need fiscal responses, and I think we've been very reluctant to put in place something like a restitution tax, a wealth tax, or a solidarity tax. We can call it what we want, but I think that would also send a very strong message that really the inequality levels in our country are immoral, and there are things that we need to be addressing. I think that's all, Craig.
Thank you, Charlene. And I think the last question that we haven't answered, Chairperson, is your question about scholar transport. And you're asking what alternative proposals we might put forward here. And I'm not able to answer your question flat off the spot, and I'm going to ask Peter if he has any immediate thoughts in by way of response.
Okay,
Peter,
I think we've answered most of the questions and all of the questions.
Chairperson?
I haven't touched on the scholar transport issue because I haven't done any work on the scholar transport issue, so I'm unable to give concrete responses and feedback on the scholar transport, Chair.
Sorry for ambushing. But not only is lost, now that you are aware of our interests, I'm sure you would not have a problem in going back and just putting down something on paper, like our engagement with you is also going to become much more craft, implementing good and concrete recommendations that we have. So that's why I'm saying if we can go and reflect on the scholar transport and advice, you know, with advice, we can say what is going to be applicable and, you know, then what's not going to apply, then.
Madam Chair, could I just ask a question to clarify the scholar transport? Is it the fact that it's around payment of suppliers around scholar transport? Is that the problem? Or is it the fact that the scholar transport system is not working as optimally in itself?
From what I'm saying, I'll say that there's no standard practice.
Okay.
Some provinces, the public website
No, thank you so much. I know that you have really responded adequately. You have even given us more information, and that has helped us to be able to look at things from a broader perspective. For instance, in my case, I may expose my ignorance of the memes country. Yes, Britain countries, we are all familiar with it. Memes came as fresh information as at all.
It's old information, I'm okay, sorry.
Come again?
It's old information at the moment.
Old. To us, it's fresh information. So that meaning that you have enriched us. So after this, you can go back and follow on this, because it, also in this way, you have to do some comparative studies, you know, such as NH, meaning, but also take informed decision. Honourable members, do you have follow-up questions?
Yes, Chair. Just two things. About the community education and training colleges. If we could have a bit of a detailed understanding of, I'm not saying now, perhaps it's something that you must, you'd go back and have a really deep look into. What has been the purpose of the of establishing community colleges? Secondly, how much work, depending on what's the purpose thereof, has been done thus far in ensuring that these community colleges indeed achieve what they were supposed to, were created to achieve? And are they indeed doing what they were supposed to, were created to achieve? I'm raising this question, Chairperson, because we the last time we met the Higher Education and Training Department in the presence of the previous Minister of Higher Education, we got the sense that part of what these colleges are supposed to do is to, just beyond, you know, partly addressing the illiteracy question, their aim is also to how do I want to put this? Recognize the skills that, the informal skills that people, our people have, and then in the process translate those into formal certificated skills. The minister used an example of someone who has the skill to bake cakes in his or her kitchen. You know, and there are many of these who bake wedding cakes and all sorts of other nice cakes. But, you know, those skills are informal. You therefore use these colleges to formalize those skills, certificate these people so that they can enter into the formal business, establish their formal businesses out there. I quoted an example of people we call the bush mechanics, who keep thousands of these cars running every day in our streets, you know, transporting commuters to and from workplaces. And we call them bush colleges. They charge 250 rand here and 500 rand there and some 150 rand here, etc., and so on. And they are not at all benefiting from this huge
motor vehicle insurance industry, precisely because they have no certificated qualification, formal qualification that allows them to establish formal businesses, formal workshop, employ people, etc., and so on and so on. And I'm saying we got the sense that, that those these colleges were supposed to do, to play that dual role, address the illiteracy problem together with the other other illiteracy programs that are there in government, but also deal with this question of the informal skills that are everywhere among black people in many instances. Now, I'm asking Chairperson if you could have a look at these colleges and actually establish quite firmly what exactly the policy around them, the purpose for which they were established. Are they doing what they're supposed to do? Are they, and how far are we in achieving those objectives? Because you're dealing with people here who can't go back to TVET colleges. You're dealing with people who can't go back to universities or to schools. But you also want to lift them up into the formal economy so that they can benefit benefit from this formal economy that we have. So that's one. Now on racism, Chairperson, let me say this. Allow me to say this, Chairperson. I'm glad that this racism has now come out in the open. I'm really glad. Because we covered it up. From 1994 up to this point, and called ourselves a rainbow nation, in a very honest hope that this rainbow nation was going to be a heaven-inspired miracle. As in biblical times, that would, make racism vanish. I'm glad it has flared up in this manner. Now we know what we're dealing with. You know, when former President Mbeki raised this issue and continuously warned us that there was racism in the country, he was attacked left, right, and center. By a whole range of sectors of our society. When the sitting president, President Zuma, took on and raised this issue, he has been continuously attacked from various sectors of our society. And here is the reality coming out in the open. I'm glad it has. Now we must become really serious and not cover it up. We must be serious and say, here we have it in our eyes, as blunt and as open as it was pre-1994, so that we are able to heal ourselves systematically of racism. Let's openly deal with it and not try and cover it up by all sorts of other things. And thus we shall in the process arrive at social cohesion. We shall in the process arrive at a non-racial society. But if we want, if we try to cover up, it's not going to help us. We can, of course I agree that there are certain things that must be outlawed. And of course people must be punished if they persist in doing these things. But I think we need a fresh and frank dialogue on this issue. If we continue to cover it up, you know, one of the MPs joked the other day and said, you know, we are called the rainbow nation, but I look at the rainbow up in the sky and I don't see the black color. It's such a beautiful thing, you look at it up in the sky there, and we call ourselves this very beautiful, natural thing, but it doesn't have this color, so said this gentleman. Now here we are. So I think we really have an important task. Let me leave it at that, Jefferson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. So the response that you ask for us in writing in relation to the scholar transport, we will go in and look at that and see how we might respond to that. And we may have to come back to talk to you in relation to just what level of detail and texture you may wish to have for such a response. But the interesting issues raised by Honourable Mbasa about these colleges, I will go and ask one of our executive directors who has a much better understanding of these issues than I have to write a response to your question, sir. And we will send that back to you. Just to say on the last question of racism, we are deeply involved inside of our organization in dealing with these questions. We have just begun a major new flagship project on well-being inside of our organization, and these issues of race and racism are I think really prominent in thinking about how people come to a sense of what their well-being is all about, and we will come to talk to you in the future about what this work is, what it signifies, what kind of lessons we might be taking away from it, and promise to return to this even briefly in a future engagement which we may have with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As we are drawing closer to the end of the of this administration, I think we left with about 16 months. What are those areas of focus that we'd like to spend our time on, energy and time on, so that at least we make an impact even in this remaining period? So we want to be so focused and make an impact in our work in the remaining period. So it was in that background that we then looked at who are our key stakeholders. I said, no, let's also invite you to assist us there. But thank you very much. We received that briefing. Yes, and it will be of no for good use. Yes, not it will be for good use. for good use. Thank you so much. The meeting between ourselves
And you is agent. But also, honourable members, I don't see us proceeding with the meetings. I'm sorry, are you with the minutes? I want to say minutes, and now I'm saying meetings. I don't see us proceeding with the minutes. We do not form the quorum. So it simply says we will not proceed with it. But I've got two correspondences that I would like to share with the members. Not just that, and then from there we close. Thank you very much. You are excused.